This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith. The truth can be difficult to hear. It's even harder when somebody kicks a sacred green cow like recycling. When John Buffington wrote to me about his new book saying recycling is a myth, standing in the way to a greener world, I got defensive. When he told me he was a corporate exec for a major American beer company, I told him no. But Jack, as he's called, is also a postdoctoral researcher at one of the premier universities in Sweden, the country with the lowest landfill rate in the world. Add to that my own doubts that what I recycle is actually heading anywhere useful. And here we go with the new book, The Recycling Myth, Disruptive Innovation to Improve the Environment. Jack Buffington, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be with you.
Let's start with your credentials. As I understand it, you research what actually happens to our coffee cups and packaging in both Europe and America. Is that right?
That's correct, Alex.
All right. Now, Americans, at least green Americans, tend to picture Europe as the leader in cutting consumer waste. True or false?
Alex, I think it is true. And I think it's true because it's better than what's being done in North America. And as I call it, it's good. But what we need to solve environmental challenges is great. So as has been said, good is the enemy of great. And I think our goals should be higher than what they are today.
All right. Now, in the old days, Jack, a person could see the local dump, maybe take out a few things that could be used again. Now, waste hauling's a huge industry. Is the waste industry, because it's so efficient, part of the problem?
I think it is. But I wouldn't categorize them as the culprit because they're on the back end of the supply chain system, and they're doing what us consumers are asking them to do, and that's to whisk away the waste. My premise is that we need to fix this problem on the front end, and then I think the waste managements of the world will respond differently if the front end of the supply chain is fixed.
Now, the front end, you mean the actual design of, let's say, beverage containers that we use.
That's correct, Alex. That's my main premise, is that while collecting materials and recycling them is good, it'll never be great and we'll never reach full reuse if these materials weren't designed to be recycled in the first place.
And weren't they?
A couple of them are. The aluminum can is highly recyclable. You can take a used aluminum can and turn it into a new aluminum can with a high level of efficiency. Glass bottles, if they're being used over and over again in a returnable manner, are highly recyclable, of course. But that also does cause some supply chain issues with higher fuel costs because the containers are heavier. But then we run into the fastest growing container, and that is plastic containers. And these containers were not designed to be recycled.
In fact, they were designed to be anti-nature in a way, you write in your book.
Yes, it's an unfortunate truth. And you know, when I went to Sweden, my goal was to bring back to the United States a European-style zero waste. And I eventually got to the point where I realized that this material is the largest problem in the recycling chain.
You know, if my wife goes and gets a coffee, it says right on the cup that it's 100% organic and totally recyclable. What is the happy cup fallacy you write about in your book, The Recycling Myth?
It's the premise that if a company puts on the container that it can be recycled, that people assume that it will be recycled. So all they have to do is take that coffee, well, coffee cups aren't, but you can take a water bottle and put it in your own little plastic container, and then after that, the problem gets solved. That is only true in a small number of cases. So that plastic water bottle that you throw in your recycling container has to have value. And if it doesn't have value, it won't be reused, even though you've gone through the effort to recycle it.
So what is downcycling and why does that matter?
It matters because when you take a plastic water bottle and you recycle it and then you turn it into that plastic decking or something that doesn't have the same value, that's creating a strain on the environment where in order to create a new water bottle, you have to extract oil or you have to extract aluminum or paper. So you haven't solved the problem of the environment because you continue to pull natural resources into the supply chain by not taking a plastic water bottle and turning it back into a plastic water bottle, or taking aluminum and turning it into an aluminum can, or even upcycling it by turning it into a car or a building or an airplane.
Okay, now we know that a lot of our plastic bottles are made from petroleum products, and that has problems as far as climate change goes. So some companies like Coca-Cola and Nestle's are introducing bottles made from plant material instead of fossil fuels. Will they help reduce our carbon emissions?
In my point of view, as long as the bottle is manufactured in the same way as a petroleum-based bottle, it will not. So if you take an organic material and you plasticize it, it cannot be recycled. So all you've done is taken a front-end material that is renewable and then turned it into an inorganic problem on the back end. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is that there's so many different types of biomaterials that it's caused a strain on the recycling systems, making it even harder to collect and reuse these materials.
All right, and you write about allegedly green bottles like NatureWorks from Cargill. Do they just naturally biodegrade? I mean, I picture if I get one of these bottles and I just toss it over by the side of the road, it's going to somehow melt back into nature. Is that true?
It is not true. And again, it gets into the whole polymerization process. So if you take a natural material and you use a manufacturing process that is unnatural, the end result is a synthetic material, even though it originally started off as corn. So the difference between a petroleum-based bottle and a Cargill corn PLA-based bottle in the end is pretty much negligible.
And what does it take to really compost those PLA bottles?
There are a few industrial composting operations in the United States. And if you throw it in your normal recycling stream, you can't expect that it's going to get to one of those composting facilities. The other problem you have is in a lot of countries around the world, especially in Asia, these water bottles are ending up in the ocean. And obviously, there's a difference between biodegradation and photodegradation. So this is creating an environmental problem, and there's a lot of confusion around what composting and biodegradable and photodegradable means. Most consumers don't understand what it means, and most recycling facilities aren't equipped to handle it as well. So there's just a few industrial facilities, and the likelihood of your compostable container getting to it is very, very rare.
Why did San Francisco stop using them?
I think the problem is that they believe that these materials could be handled very easily, and then when they found out that the supply chain system couldn't handle it, then they quickly realized that it was a bigger problem than actually using a PET bottle where there was recycling infrastructure to handle it.
Now, we talked about the difference in culture between Europe and America. What on earth is a bin cam?
So in the UK, I think there was a company, a university that looked at social media as a way to increase recycling rates. So there's a recycling container in the United Kingdom. A camera would be attached to it. So you could increase acculturation of recycling by putting the camera there, and all your friends could see what you're doing and what you're not doing.
They could see what you had for dinner.
Yeah, that's right. They could see if you're eating things are good and bad for you. And again, I think this gets into more of a folly than it gets into a real solution that's going to help both the economy and the environment.
Yeah, I had to love your chapter subhead titled EU Sustainability Slowing Down the Planetary Collapse. Tell us about that.
Well, I think this is where I really appreciate your open-mindedness in talking about this, because a lot of people would look at my title and say, wow, if you're against recycling, you're against the environment. And the only thing that our recycling programs are doing today is mitigating how much plastic is going into our ocean, mitigating the impact on CO2 and all the other impacts. It's not solving the problem. If these containers can't be reused, you can't take an old container and turn it into a new container, then you're not helping the environment. All you're doing is slowing down how quickly it creates the problem that we know of today.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Jack Buffington. He's a supply chain specialist and a researcher who's published a book about the myths of recycling. Now, despite your research for a Swedish university, you don't seem to suggest that America go forward towards these zero waste policies. Why not?
Well, the first reason for this is that I actually went there to do so, and I looked at what was happening in Sweden, and I saw that despite the fact that Sweden is advertised as a zero waste nation, it only recycles about 35% of its materials. 50% of its materials are incinerated in a waste energy scheme. Now, it's a clean way of handling it. So when Sweden burns its excess waste in order to turn it into electricity, it captures the effluent so it doesn't go into the air, but it's downcycling. So I started to see the reason why this is the case, and the reason why this is the case is because Sweden is using the same materials that we are, and if these materials can't be reused in the United States at a high level, they can't be reused in Sweden at a high level. So I also thought about differences between our cultures. In Sweden, there is a high culture of conformity towards the environment, and we don't have this culture in the United States. So even if these programs worked in Sweden, which they do not, it would be very difficult to get Americans to adopt to it. So in my opinion, the right way of handling this is to use innovation to create these materials that can be reused, and therefore there will be acceptance by Americans because these are programs that will work, and they won't require Americans to go through all the steps of recycling that a very environmentalist Sweden will do that an American won't.
And how does the United Kingdom compare to countries like Sweden or Germany when it comes to handling the waste stream?
I think the United Kingdom is probably halfway in between the United States and Sweden. So their recycling rates are not as high, so there is waste. It is more of a market-based approach. So the recycling rates in the United Kingdom are higher than they are in Sweden, but you don't have that culture of adoption. So when things don't work, you start to have people who start to lose commitment to the programs. So talking to a lot of people in the United Kingdom, there seems to be even though the EU directives want their recycling rates to be higher, there's a lack of conformity in the culture because they just don't see this as solving the problem.
And could you just, Jack Buffington, give us a quick little snapshot about the attitudes towards recycling in Japan?
Japan is a nation with maybe the highest conformity to recycling programs, and it makes a lot of sense because this is an island nation. Natural resources are hard to come by, and it also happens to be an island nation that's very close to a large manufacturing nation called China that will take all of its recycling materials and reuse them. So I would also say that there's a lot of innovation in how the Japanese look at it, but I think it's an anomaly if you compare how things are in the United States or Canada or Mexico or even in Europe. So it is a great example, but I don't think you could look at what they're doing and apply it to our geography or our culture.
You mentioned Mexico. You're set to do a talk in Mexico City, which you say is headed towards an environmental catastrophe. What's that about?
Absolutely. Actually, I was there 2 weeks ago, and Mexico is now the largest consumer of water bottles, and it has a lot to do with a growing population and also a poor water distribution system. So Mexico does a very nice job of recycling materials like aluminum that are valuable, but water bottles and plastic are recycled at a very low rate, if at all. And this is creating an environmental problem. And it's not only in Mexico, but it's also in developing nations in Asia. In fact, the top five nations responsible for plastic in the ocean are all Asian nations. These are countries with growing consumer populations and no recycling infrastructure. They do not have the recycling infrastructure in place that we have in the United States, Canada, or Europe. And so this is a growing environmental problem that is not going to be solved with traditional recycling programs if they take 10 years to get into place.
Right. We just need better containers in the first place. And that's where you started out with your book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, in the village where I live, everything except glass is dumped into a single big metal bin, and that's hauled away, as they say. And I've heard it shipped all the way to China to be separated and processed there. That sounds insane, and it must be hard on China. What really happens to that trash in China?
Well, China has adopted a new program called a Green Fence Program, where they are more particular about trash that's coming from Europe, Canada, and the United States. So this has also created a larger landfill problem in Canada and the United States, where we cannot dump our waste to developing nations. But the even stranger part of this is that in a city like Beijing, a lot of its plastic is used very, very poorly, and recycling rates are really low, even though they're receiving all of this plastic from other nations. So there's not a lot of good controls in place, and there's a lot of environmental damage associated with it.
I'm told the last paper recycling mills in Canada are at risk of closing because these single-use recycling bins produce paper and cardboard that are soaked in so much food waste they can't be used for quality paper. What have you heard about that?
That is exactly true, is most companies use what is called industrial grade corrugated. So that means that, you know, companies like Miller Coors or Coke or Pepsi will collect the corrugated, and that is clean paper that can be reused. But the paper that goes into your recycling bin is often not used for the reasons that you just mentioned. It's contaminated. And it's not just paper, it's also glass. In the United States, in the single stream recycling, 40% of all glass that's collected is thrown away, and I think that number is growing. So the unfortunate side of the story is that a lot of consumers will only be put out enough to do single stream recycling, but that creates a lot of waste and not a lot of good recycling materials to reuse.
Now, Jack Buffington, I appreciated your hard looks at the realities of recycling until I got to your solutions. So I think we should go back to the beginning. Why do you say that current recycling may be standing in the way of real solutions?
Because I think that being an employee for a consumer products company, being a consumer, seeing how the whole supply chain works, there's a feeling of contentment that all companies have to do, or all consumers have to do, is throw these containers in another container and the problem solved. In the publicity of my book, I've talked to a lot of waste management and environmentalist professionals, and the sad story that they're telling me is that there is a lack of passion around this issue because people just think that the problem is being solved. It's not being solved. There needs to be greater awareness of what's happening, and I think if there would be, that there would be a greater emphasis to solve the problem instead of partial efforts of mitigation.
Why do you think a voluntary recycling program will work better than charging people at the cash register for bottles or any consumer waste?
Well, I don't think a voluntary program would work better. What I believe would work better is a voluntary mandatory program. So I call it a voluntary recycling program. And how it would work is that as a consumer, you would purchase your containers at a supermarket. You would use your loyalty card. And at that point, you would have a choice to either recycle or not. If you promised to recycle, you wouldn't be charged the deposit. If you didn't promise to recycle, you would. And after 30 days, if you promised and you didn't, you would be charged that deposit. And the reason why this will work better is that this would be a self-funded program. And recycling programs in Europe, Canada, United States are not self-funding. So they run into a problem of either a program deficit, which governments don't want to fund, or they run into a problem where they're not providing the full deposit back to the consumer. So this approach will actually make the program self-funded. But in the end, as a consumer, if you're not going to recycle, you should be charged the deposit. And so what this does is put the opportunity with the consumer to make the right decision.
In Europe, laws make retailers and manufacturers responsible for their packaging waste. Isn't that a good idea for Americans and Canadians too?
It is a good idea if it's market-based. The reason why it doesn't work in Europe is if you look at these containers, if you would say a large consumer products company is responsible for its containers, and yet if you look at these containers that they're using, they're the same containers that are not able to be recycled. So it needs to be an approach where we actually really hold these companies responsible for their containers, not general PET plastic containers. So you would say to company X that your container needs to be 50% recyclable, and if it's not, we're going to charge you a penalty. That would give the company incentive to make changes in the composition of its containers rather than what's happening today.
Looking at other options, Jack, what is aerogel?
Aerogel is a material of the future, and it's not going to be ready anytime soon. So it's a nanomaterial. And the reason why I chose, this is an example in my book to highlight, is that I believe that we're on the cusp of a material science revolution. And for those of us old enough to remember the late 90s when the dot-com revolution changed how we do business through e-business, I think in the future there's these new materials that are nanomaterials that are going to offer the same industrial specifications, but in a way that's going to not just not hurt the environment, that's going to improve the environment. So what will happen is there will be a link between the environment and industry that complements one another, as opposed to economic growth coming at the negative impact on the environment. So aerogel, there's other possibilities, and I think there's possibilities that we can't even conceive today. But what I want to have happen is I want there to be more emphasis on material science, and some of these chemists and metallurgists and people I'm talking to let them solve this problem through new definitions of containers rather than trying to solve the problem on the back end of containers we've been using for 30 years that have been proven not to be environmental.
Now, I totally agree with the dream that you just described to us, but I have to say I'm a little worried about nanotech or any new material we will invent, because we have a past history of creating things that turn out later to be really harmful. And, we make these things with a lot of enthusiasm, little testing, and not much suspicion about our intentions or abilities. Why aren't you worried about nanotech?
Look, I think we look at it this way, is that you're absolutely right about some of these technologies. But again, they're not being designed for recycle. They're not being designed for the environment. So we need to look at the supply chain system, the industrial supply chain system, as an extension to our environment. And we need to look at the ecosystems in our natural environment as an extension of our industrial systems. So these materials that you talk about were not designed with that in mind. But in the future, I think there's great possibilities for that to be the case. And I think companies are going to see that in their best interest to design materials that are complementary to nature. And I think there's going to be money to be made for these. And I'm really leery of solutions that try to look at industry and the environment as two antagonistic parties, and it's on both sides of the table. I think there's a future for this, to look at it differently, and I think probably a lot of people in your audience are younger, and they will look at this thing with a different mindset than some of the older people. So I believe there's great opportunities for this, but it's going to take some time. I just think we need to focus on it, and it will come sooner.
Now, I have one final complaint about one statement in your book. You say, a model of consumer austerity is not only un-American and anti-evolution, but also unnecessary. I couldn't agree less. I think we need a complete reorganization of civilization to live within the planetary means. Do you really think we can just tweak the consumer model of society and keep on going?
It's not a tweak at all. It's an absolute transformation. And let's think of it this way. When I was in Mexico City, with the large amounts of poverty that exist there, if we said that we're going to save the environment, but at the same time it's going to impact the economy, I don't think a lot of people in developing societies would be okay with that. So the reason why I said it's unnecessary, Alex, is because if we live in the same industrial model that we lived in the last 200 years, I absolutely agree with you. But there's got to be a paradigm shift on how business works within the environment. And if you think about it, economic growth could happen through dematerialization. So if you think about it, a smartphone, think about all the different things that your smartphone can do that 20 years ago you had a computer, you had a telephone, you had an alarm clock. And so I think there's a way to transform things through the use of materials to dematerialize at the same time leads to economic growth. So I think that even if you tried to stop innovation, you won't. So what we have to push for is a model between the economy and the environment that is complementary so that we achieve goals of improving people's lives at the same time improving the environment.
Jack, do you have a website or Facebook page for people to follow up?
I have a Twitter account. It's JBuffy1. I'm not on Facebook, and I do not have a website yet.
Okay. Our guest is John, or Jack, Buffington. He does research for the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. He's a specialist in supply chain management for MillerCoors Brewing Company in Colorado. Buffington has written several books, including Progress, Technology, and 7 Billion People, A New Solution for Capitalism. I think his newest book, The Recycling Myth, Disruptive Innovation to Improve the Environment, is definitely worth the read, whether it's for business people, politicians, but especially for Greens who need to get real about the greenwashing that's going on with our waste. Jack, thank you so much for your vision and for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.